Okay. We are in Daniel chapter 11, looking in verse 40 tonight. We're into those final verses, beginning in verse 36, when it starts talking about the king. We talked last week about it could be a continuation of a discussion about Antiochus Epiphanes. Many people think that. But it really doesn't fit. Even those who teach it that way get to a place where they say these things really don't make sense. It doesn't really fit. And so we move into the area that we consider this to be the Antichrist, someone that's coming in the future. Last week we talked verses 36 through verse 39. We'll just read through them quick again. And that seems to kind of discuss his character and who he is. A good strike against that being Antiochus or Antiochus Epiphanes is that we've already introduced Antiochus Epiphanes and it kind of described him as a contemptible person and other things. So it seems like it's somebody else. In verse 40 to the end of the chapter, verse 45, it talks about some of the last battles. And I guess I'll just say it here. I always want to, especially in end times, I try to keep an open mind. I've got my theology, my timeline, and shove it into everything. Because when other people do that, when they teach from a different point of view, like the preterist point of view or amillennial point of view, it just is irritating because they're really not teaching. They're just taking they're doing that, what we call eisegesis. They're taking, this is what I believe, and this is how it fits. And it's not even teaching. You're just getting indoctrinated. And so I don't want to do that. Of course, it happens. Whatever you believe, you do it. But I'm thinking these events are taking place here in that last 7 years of Daniel. And we've already referred to it earlier about a man referred to as the little horn. So again, it is not unusual that Daniel would be talking about what we call the Antichrist or this man, the king of the final kingdom. Again, we've got this is little toes, okay, the statue of the toes. This is the kingdom of the end. It says in the times of that kingdom, or in the times of that king or those kings, that's when the statue gets struck by the rock. And so we've already talked about the little horn. I think it's chapter 7. We've talked about the statue in Daniel chapter 2. And so the Antichrist now at the end would not be like, whoa, 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 what are you doing? Why are you talking about the Antichrist? Well, it's just another way of referring to him. Just like we've talked about Alexander the Great several times, being the leopard or being the goat. Or Antiochus Epiphanes was mentioned several places. And so again, I have no trouble saying that. I just don't want to railroad you into this and saying, well, this is now we're talking about the tribulation. But I am going to approach it from that perspective that we are in Daniel's last seven. And again, that's not too strange because it comes out of the book of Daniel. I mean, it's where it's introduced at is in this book. And so again, it makes complete sense to continue with that thought. And then, of course, it reads into chapter 12, and this is all part of the same vision. It just keeps right on going, and there's several interesting things in chapter 12 as Daniel kind of wraps it up, and the angels give him some final information. Well, let's bow our heads. I'll pray, and I'm going to read through these verses beginning in verse 36 and explain some things. And we're going to be going to Zechariah tonight, Zechariah 13. We'll be going to Revelation, a couple places in Revelation. Looking at some verses. Well, we could also, at least we need to talk about Ezekiel 38 and 39, because what we're going to introduce here, in verses 40 through 45, are the battles that this king that we're introducing is going to fight, and those that will come against him. And are those battles in the tribulation? Some would say it's Armageddon that's being discussed, but there's, as we go through this, it's kind of like, I don't know. It doesn't really sound like Armageddon yet. It sounds like battles leading up to Armageddon. Some would say it's Ezekiel 38 being repeated because it talks about an invasion from the north. But again, it doesn't really match up exactly the same way. There's things that make it, at least in my mind, different. And again, I'm very, I don't want to say apologetic, but I'm very careful or cautious because there's some very good scholars. I mean, scholars that I respect. If someone's a preterist, it's like, okay, you can be a preterist, but your theology's breaking down. I'm not even convinced. But there are some people that have good eschatology that I think, and they place this Ezekiel 38, Gog and Magog, they place it, as we've talked about before, at the end of the millennium, potentially. They call it Armageddon. It's the Battle of Armageddon. Some put it at the midway point of the tribulation. I put it somewhere right here. Now, not that I'm right. I'm just, these are all options for Ezekiel 38 and 39, and it just makes sense to me that it's something that's initiating something else. It's like the beginning of the seven-year treaty that begins with peace. But again, there's reasons why that doesn't fit. So all these options, it's real dangerous, unless you got a real good teaching, to say I'm absolutely right and everybody else is wrong on some of these things. So we'll look at Ezekiel 38 and see if that fits there. And so we'll be going to some of those places. Well, let's bow our heads. I'll pray, and we'll get started. Father, we thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the opportunity to study it in a country where we are free to look into it. And we do pray that this word would change our lives, it would change our hearts, and that the power that is within this word would affect our nation itself and our culture. We do pray for revival among our people, and ask that we may see your hand move in our nation again. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, let's begin in chapter 11, verse 36. And the verse right before this, I've just finished talking about the Maccabean revolt and the things that take place. And most scholars agree with that. Verse 36 is where the breakdown takes place of which way you're going to go. Is this a continuation of the Maccabean revolt and Antiochus Epiphanes? Or if we jumped into the future, talking about someone that is yet to come. Anyway, it says here, the king will do as he pleases, identifying, his arrogance. He'll exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. Blasphemous. He will be successful. Okay, so he's going to be allowed to be successful. And again, that's one thing we see in God's plan is sometimes evil abounds, but it is limited. There's a time limit on it until the time of wrath is completed. Now, this time of wrath, I think, again, if you allow me to say it, again, you need to keep thinking. This time of wrath would be referring to this tribulation, this period of wrath. And this, I hope to get, I want to maybe even get into Romans chapter 9, 10, 11 a little bit tonight. We'll see. But this time of wrath right here is a time of drawing Israel in, of judging and drawing Israel in, so that there is going to be revival in Israel, especially during those last 3.5 years. So the time of wrath is judgment, but it's a purification process that's to take place. We can see that in other scriptures. But nonetheless, it refers to here, until the time of wrath is completed. Now, this could apply to the Maccabean revolt, the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. Indeed, that was a time of wrath also, but it doesn't continue. You cannot continue to teach that in these verses. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers. Now again, verse 37 seems to be talking about deities and gods. He'll show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but he will exalt himself above them all. So he places himself in a position of God. So there's four references to deities there. Instead of them, now this is the God he'll honor. Besides himself, he'll honor a god of fortress or military power, a god unknown to his fathers. Again, that's the second time we mentioned this is a new religion, or it's new at least in these verses. However, are we talking about 2,000-3,000 years of it wasn't available 3,000 years ago, but now it is available? Or is this a change that took place in one generation? His dad didn't do this, but now 10 years later, he's doing it. So again, you just kind of keep that in mind. Again, when the truth arrives, all these things will make sense. And I think you've got to be honest about this. And anyone who is nailing this down, saying, I've got this, this is exactly what's going to happen, you need to be a little careful because it hasn't happened yet. You can have ideas, but when it does take place, it's going to be a perfect fit, and you won't have to necessarily stretch and try and figure it out. Think about a good example would be Jesus in his ministry. Jesus was born, and he fulfilled prophecy just by walking through his life. It just happened. And when it was all said and done, you didn't really have to stretch it. You just had to allow it to speak. This was it. This was him. It happened. And, of course, people for before and even after have been trying to fulfill some of those same prophecies by trying to figure out how it could be squeezed in. But when it happens, it'll be obvious in many cases. Instead of them, he'll honor a god of fortress, a god unknown to his fathers. He'll honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. So, again, there's going to be a lot of money put into this God, a lot of money put into the military that's going to be supporting this action, this belief, this culture, this government, this kingdom. He'll attack the mightiest fortresses. The mightiest fortresses would probably refer to other nations or places that have good militaries or great militaries. He's not afraid of them. He'll attack the best militaries with the help of a foreign god. Now, who's this foreign god? Is it Satan? Is it his the deity that he's worshiping? Is it some kind of a religious base, is it some kind of a cult or a religion that's supporting him? And will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. So anyone who comes alongside and says, okay, we accept this, we acknowledge you as our leader, we acknowledge your religion, we recognize your God, boom, you're in. So to get into this, you simply have to acknowledge. It's like, and that's when John starts writing about the mark of the beast. You receive the mark, you've acknowledged it, boom, you're in, you've got favor, and you great honor. For example, in Revelation, you'll get to buy food. Congratulations, a great honor. You get the privilege of eating today. But again, we can see that another place where he's going to be referring to dividing up the land and giving to those who support him. Will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He'll make them rulers over many people. And so again, this is now governments or groups of people that come to him. He'll again supply them not just with food, but with political advantages. And here it says, will distribute the land at a price. In Joel 3, it also says that God is coming to judge because they've divided his land. And that land would have to be the land of Israel, we would think. But to distribute the land at a price. Now again, you could read that, distribute the land, the lands that he conquers, he distributes the lands. Or is this talking specifically about the land of Israel? I think in Joel 3, it's talking specifically about they've divided the land of Israel, and partialed it out. And that ticks God off. And here, you could read that in here also. Again, I'm just laying these things out. They're trying to just, you know, be drawn up and try and say, we've got it figured out. This guy is the Antichrist. This is what's taking place, because most Antichrists have died. You know, anytime you identify an Antichrist, he up and dies, and then your whole, you know, ministry shot. Verse 40. Now we begin some new material, at least as far as a little more detail. At that time of the end, notice right here, time of the end. Now, again, if you're going to try and make this fit with the Maccabean revolt, it'd be the end of the Maccabean revolt, which would be 165, 163, 160 in that in general area, or whenever Antiochus Epiphanes died. But probably, I mean, this speaks of the end, because it's not really identified. It's the ultimate end, the end of human history as we know it. And again, that's been a theme of Daniel's book. Remember, all the little horn gets overthrown by the Lord. The toes in the statue are crushed by the stone. The Antichrist, the same way, is going to be overpowered by the coming of the Lord. And that's backed up in Revelation 19, 2 Thessalonians. He is going to be, when the majesty of the Lord is revealed, he's wiped out. So again, when we say end, this book is about the end. So again, it's not like, well, how, why? Now all of a sudden you're introducing this into the 11th chapter. Well, no, this is out of the second chapter. We've been talking about it all the way through. And so again, I have no trouble thinking this is the time of the end of human history as we know it. The king of the south will engage him in battle. So we know now, let's draw besides our little timeline up here, let's add to our media presentation a map. So here it is. Ta-da! Media presentation, Jerusalem. The king of the south, we know it would possibly be Egypt. When we say king of the south, again, when we look at this, a lot of these things, this doesn't take place just like this. At this point is where people who are trying to make this be Antiochus Epiphanes, it breaks down for them. This does not happen historically. Antiochus Epiphanes goes east and dies in Persia, and these events never happen. So let me say this one more time. I said it last week. Those who believe the book of Daniel is a forgery from around 168 or 165 B.C., about the Maccabean revolt, they can go through and they can identify everything up to this point because it's happened historically, and they write this book making it sound apocalyptic, like this is something we knew ahead of time to encourage the people, and they say that's what the book of Daniel is about. Many, many Bible teachers, many, many churches adapted that. They cannot accept the book of Daniel at face value. What they say happens here is whoever is writing in 168 or 165 B.C. this forgery, they're going out on a limb and kind of predicting, they're actually trying to guess what's going to happen, like you're trying to guess what's going to happen in the November elections. And you'd be writing, this is what's going to happen. And then, of course, Antiochus Epiphanes dies, and then nothing happens. And so, in other words, these verses are part of the forgery, but there wasn't any historical events yet to base them on. They're just kind of guessing, and this is where they derail, because now they're trying to predict the future. They thought they could, and they didn't. You understand what I just said? And then that's just that. I'm just saying, if you get into a discussion, that's how some people would try to explain it. I am talking about this being the time of the end, and this is Egypt, but it says the king of the south. In the previous verses, the king of the south, the Ptolemies, came out of Egypt. But as we read this today, this could be a coalition of kings or militaries coming from the south. As we go across it, they'd be Muslim nations. Now, if you play, again, we're just making suggestions, if you play into this Islam and make the Islam part of the Antichrist, part of the king, the final kingdom. It works. It makes a lot of sense, especially like we said before, when you consider the events are going to take place in Jerusalem. The Temple Mount is involved. And Islam has controlled the Temple Mount basically for 1,600 years. It's pretty obvious they're going to be part of it, unless, of course, they just disappear from history and melt out of the Middle East and someone else comes in and occupies it, like the Catholic Church or something, you know. Which, you know, I mean, anything could happen. But again, if we allow Islam in here, and the King of the South right now would be Muslim nations, unless, of course, there's a great revival down there, you know, like, you know, Jehovah Witnesses go down there and convert them or something. The King of the South would probably have Muslim ties. And so this would be potentially a block of Muslim nations, and they're going to be invading the King of the North. Now, the King of the North, I'll just write King of the North right here. Who is he? Is that the Antichrist? We're already talking about the king, okay? So we may have three kings here: the King of the South, the King of the North, and then the original king we're talking about. Okay, you understand what I'm saying? Because we're talking about the king, and also we throw in the King of the North is coming in. Is that a new king, or is that another name for the Antichrist? Okay, we'll talk about that in just a minute. But what I'm trying to say is this: whatever happens, if this is the King of the South, and it's Egypt, or adding on some Muslim nations beside them, you will notice you have Muslim nations invading potentially a Muslim state right here, or a Muslim leader, a Muslim Antichrist. You see what I'm saying? In other words, that would maybe mean this is not Muslim. The Antichrist would not be Muslim, because why would these guys attack a Muslim? Okay, so now you're back to the Roman Catholic Church or something else as the Antichrist. Okay, but we may be seeing here the foretelling of a deterioration of the Muslim nations as a unified force. You know, we think, for example, I think, you know, well, they're Muslims, they're all united. But I think, in the little bit that I know, a Muslim in Saudi Arabia and that kingdom is different than a Muslim in Egypt. I mean, they're different cultures. And then you combine it with someone here who's an Antichrist who's trying to rule the world and wants all these other Muslim nations to come under their rule. It'd be like, you know, the governor of Iowa trying to bring all the nations under his newly formed union. It's like, okay, we're all Americans, but we're not all going to let you be the king. And we may be seeing a deterioration here of this, what he was trying to make as a unified nation. I just want to say that as we go by, if we're talking about that. Now, let's go back and look at this. At the time of the end, so if we come, wow, we looked at that for a long time, didn't we? At the time of the end, I think we're talking about these 7 years right here, and we're probably pushing towards the second half, time of the end. We've got a series of battles. I do not think we have to, just because we talk about a battle at the time of the end, it doesn't have to be Armageddon. Even in here, you can see that this battles that they're fighting are not the final battle, because it goes on and talks about other events that happen afterwards. Because once Armageddon happens, Jesus Christ ends Armageddon with his invasion. And so I do not think this is Armageddon. Some people would, and that's fine. Listen to them, try and decide. But I'm thinking it's going to be one of these battles in this area here. In fact, like I said, I'm not even going to say it's Ezekiel 38:39. I'm thinking that happened, sets up a stage, a world stage of events, and this happens in that second half when the Antichrist is trying to organize some things, and looks like his world empire ambitions begin to deteriorate, or at least some people are in rebellion towards him. Again, he's fighting an awful lot of wars for being the world leader. Okay? He may be wanted to be, but I'm not sure how successful he's going to be. At the time of the end, the King of the South will engage him in battle. That's him. What I'm saying is the Antichrist. That's the king. And the King of the North will storm out against him with chariots and a cavalry and great fleet of ships. So now, is that King of the North, the Antichrist, is for example, is this the battle plan right here? Egypt invades the Antichrist, and the Antichrist then turns and invades Egypt with all his military force? Or is this Egypt attacking the Antichrist, and then this King of the North comes storming in and attacks him also? Again, you see what I'm saying? You can, You can pick and try and teach one way or the other. That's fine. But you all often have to come back and look at the other way you could have gone. You understand what I'm saying here? If I say this is definitely the Antichrist retaliating, okay, teach all the way through the rest of these verses, and that's fine, but you should come back and add this other idea, or maybe it's another invasion, and then teach the verses with that in mind. So you can kind of see how it lays out. You don't want to be shutting doors, otherwise you're going to end up getting in a corner like the preterists do when they get here. It's like, well, these verses really don't make any sense. Right, because you screwed up way in the beginning of the thing. And that's a good way of telling. If eventually your idea deteriorates, that's because you probably are on the wrong trail. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him, the Antichrist, in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots, cavalry, and a great fleet of ships. And I'm going to say that's the Antichrist. Now, the reason I'm saying that is this. Is if we draw this up here again, depending on who your Antichrist is, okay? If you've got a king of the north and a king of the south, and you've got an Antichrist, we're going to say he's from Rome, okay, from the west. Now you've got someone who's come in, he's not the king of the north because he's the Antichrist from the west somewhere, and he's occupying this area. Now you can have an invasion from the north and an invasion from the south from two different kings who are coming from those directions. In fact, back in the 80s, we used to take this north and put it all the way up into Russia. Okay, remember that? That was Russia coming down. Now it looks to me, it looks more like it's going to be Turkey and Syria. Okay? But if we go with some other things that we know or I think have been established, the Antichrist could be from Rome somewhere. Again, not mocking that. It's just kind of like that was an older idea, I think, as we looked at world history. That's kind of faded away in my mind. What I'm looking at is, and for several reasons, is the Antichrist coming out of Syria or this area right here. So he would be the king of the north, just like Antiochus Epiphanes. Remember we talk about the 10th Roman legion, you know, the people of the ruler who will come. They came from this area. Antiochus Epiphanes came from this area. So there's several ideas. Isaiah calls the Antichrist, refers to him as the Assyrian. Again, another clue possibly. Again, I'm not making these things as doctrinal statements. I'm just saying if that's the case, the Antichrist is going to come from Syria. Now, I did not say he's going to come from Syria. I'm saying there's several reasons he could come from Syria, which makes him the king of the north. You see, if you make this guy a Roman from the west, well, then, of course, now you can have the king of the north invading him. Otherwise, the Antichrist is coming from the north. He can't be invaded from the north because he is from the north, unless you move it all the way up to Russia. Now Russia's coming in to attack him. All right, does that make sense? Okay. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him, the Antichrist, in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. So again, I'm saying this is the king of the north. This is the Antichrist. This is who we're talking about. He is invaded by the south. Possibly Muslim nations united together, invade up into this area, invade Turkey and Syria. So now you've got to imagine in modern world history, Syria and Turkey being united, and over here the northern coast of Africa being united, and they're going to come out and they're going to engage in battle. And the can you imagine that possibly? I mean, you've got Iran trying to overrun Iraq. I mean, you got people are bombing Saudi Arabia. Iraq invaded Kuwait. It's like, aren't these people all Muslims? Don't they all get along? Yeah, just like Christians all get along. Remember when the United States fought against Germany, you know, and then they stopped and celebrated Christmas together, and then they went back to war? I mean, you know, just because you got the same religion doesn't mean your countries are going to get along, right? So anyway, the Antichrist then will come out here and storm out against the king of the south with, again, look at his arsenal. And it mentions the details, chariots, cavalry, and a great fleet of ships. You know, everything he's got, and he's got access to a lot. Remember, he's put a lot of money into his god of military. He'll invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. So when this happens, he is going to come down. He's going to occupy these areas and many countries. I mean, if that keeps going, he maybe takes Saudi Arabia, Jordan. He may take, well, again, we're going to talk about Jordan here in a minute. He doesn't take Jordan. But he may take several of these countries because someone pushed him, motivated him. And now he just goes off in war and starts conquering these kingdoms, and they all are going to fall to him. He'll invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He'll also invade the beautiful land. Now, at this time, he enters Israel. Now, I've been talking about him being in Israel kind of as in anticipation, but he maybe appears to be up in here, and at this time, he comes into Israel. Again, not that this is absolute, but realize, again, if you can remember our little tribulation chart up here. Remember, see this right here? You've got your tribulation chart, and the beginning of the tribulation is a covenant with the Antichrist, between Antichrist and Israel. Now, if you can imagine, again, if the Antichrist has something to do with Islam, who occupies the Temple Mount, it would sure appear they do, because if anyone's going to get access to the Temple Mount in the last 1,600 years, it's going to, except during the Crusades, it's going to come with some kind of an agreement with Islam or the Muslims. The Antichrist somehow makes a treaty with Israel and gives them access to the Temple Mount. That's not out of the question. It's not out of the realm of reality. Israel, as we've talked about in Jerusalem, they are ready to go up there and offer their sacrifices today. They're ready right now. So this is not even a radical thing. What's radical is that you've got potentially someone with Muslim ties giving access to it. Do you think that could possibly upset some of the other Muslims? It's like, you know, it may be a great political move, maybe very strategic for this individual, but there may be other Muslim territories that go, we do not like this. And so there may be a problem. So what I was going to say is that he makes a treaty, the Antichrist makes a treaty, and then it appears during this first 3.5 years he's building. And at this point is when that treaty is broken. So in other words, these battles, if I can make a guess, these battles may be leading up to be occurring during the first 3.5 years. Because notice, now all of a sudden, the Antichrist from the north, now he invades Jerusalem. Now he takes Israel, which may be when he stops the temple sacrifices. You see, before he's up here, he's doing his thing, he's building his world, you know, making treaties and lying and deceit, all these different things. He is a deceiver, has a treaty down here with Israel. These guys maybe don't like it. They invade him, Muslims invading Muslims, and now he's got to come down and take control of this, puts an end to the sacrifices at the 3.5 year mark. In other words, that puts verse 40 and 41 in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. And my connection there is he invades Israel, and at the halfway point is when he takes back the Temple Mount. In fact, it looks like he shows up in Israel this time. Many countries will fall. Okay, we mentioned many countries again. But Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. Now, you can speculate on that. You can try and figure out why. You know, they've got divine protection. Well, ultimately, yeah, there's divine protection. God's will is that they're delivered. But how that plays out politically, do they have a greater military? Do they have the United States backing them? Are they just not that important? Is all the oil used up and no one cares about them? But those are, that is basically Jordan and part of Saudi Arabia. Could be Jordan and Saudi Arabia are delivered from his hand. Now again, why? Why? I mean, again, now you're going to have to speculate. Why are they delivered from his hand? But many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And again, Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Edom, if you can imagine my map here. Okay, too many circles. Just so you know this probably. Here's Jerusalem, Dead Sea, Galilee. Edom is down here. Moab was right here. And Ammon was right there. Those were one. Talk about being congested. And this would be Israel, and this would be the Philistines. Talk about congestion. There's five nations right there. Well, anyway, this right now is basically Jordan right on the edge of Saudi Arabia. So it depends on how far you push Moab and Ammon and Edom to the east, you're getting into Saudi Arabia. But right now, clearly, Jordan is delivered from his hand. So if we make this a political map today, you've got Egypt and maybe some Muslim nations in a unified fashion invading Syria and Turkey. The Antichrist, who's from Syria and Turkey, will now then come back with all of his forces and take Israel back at the halfway point. So now he's got the Temple Mount. But during this time, he cannot take Jordan. He does not take Jordan. He doesn't want Jordan. They're too strong. For some reason, Jordan is delivered. So these guys, we got Syria and Turkey possibly, Egypt and some of the Muslim nations here, Israel and Jordan. Jordan's delivered. Egypt falls. And many other countries also will fall. But Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. Again, I'm just... I'm just telling you kind of the way it is. It's like I could be speculating even further, telling you, you know, this is what I think would happen. But now I'm into the area of speculation, really, and just creative thinking, you know. Verse 42, he will extend his power over many countries. So there's your idea of a world leader. But realize, many countries, it doesn't say the entire world. Right now, all we really see is a Middle Eastern player so far, just a player in the Middle East, which if that's the case, we've got a lot of territory, a lot of nations yet that are still able to get involved in this from a different side. They maybe haven't signed on. I mean, think about China. Think about Japan. Think about Russia. Think about all the European nations. Think about America, Canada, Mexico, all the way down, you know, what's going on over there. He will gain control of the treasures of, he'll extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. Now realize, Egypt is not an ally because they didn't escape. An ally doesn't escape. You know, he conquers Egypt. So the king of the south is conquered by the Antichrist. No matter who the king of the north is, okay, if you say the king of the north is also invading the Antichrist, which I don't think, but you could try to make that work. But at this point, it doesn't matter because the Antichrist takes Egypt. Egypt will not escape. Verse 43, he, the Antichrist, will gain control of the treasures of the gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and Nubians in submission, which would be Put and Cush, or basically the Northern African in Ethiopia. In other words, that's where you get that idea, the concept of a Muslim bloc. Because when he conquers Egypt, he gets these other nations too. Because why? They're part of the invasion coming up with him. And realize right here, it is now ridiculous to try and make Antiochus Epiphanes fit here. Because remember, when he came down here that last time, they drew a circle around him and says, you decide, you want to fight us Romans or you want to surrender? And he surrendered and went up and attacked Jerusalem. But then he eventually ends up in the east and dies. That was the end of his exploits in Egypt. So, with the Libyans and the Nubians in submission. But now, look at this. This is why you've got to keep in mind, this right now is a Middle Eastern conflict. Again, the way I'm showing it to you, this is a Middle Eastern conflict. Turkey and Syria, Egypt and some Muslim nations here, Jordan, Israel, it's all taking place right here. And now look at this. Verse 44, but reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. So now we're going to add into this the east. Now, how far east do you have to go? I mean, Iraq, Iran, China, you know, I mean, who is invading him? Again, if this is a Middle Eastern issue, why would China, you know, I mean, everybody says China, but why would China, is this Persia or Iraq coming into the picture? Who's coming out of the north? Are these some satellite states up here? Are these this Russia coming down? Who's from the north? Remember, when Nebuchadnezzar invaded, Jeremiah, his first chapter, he saw what? A boiling pot coming in from the north, an invasion from the north. But you know where that was from. It was from Iraq, from Babylon, which is in the east, because the invasion came from, all these invasions came up through the Megiddo Valley, you know, from Carchemish and down in. So again, I'll say this, not that I believe this, but you get in trouble with end times, and we've all seen it, if when you start to say, well, this is Russia, and this is Mussolini, and then Russia deteriorates into nothing, the Cold War is over, Mussolini dies, and you're left with, you got to throw your CDs out or your cassette tapes because no one wants to buy them because they don't make sense anymore. And so you got to be careful when you do this. So I will suggest this. Again, I don't believe this, but this could be as simple as, but reports from the east, Iran, and north, Iraq, because Jeremiah already called Iraq or Babylon an invasion from the north, and then Persia would be from the east. It could be that simple. This could be nothing more than Muslim nations fighting with each other, trying to get control of Israel after the Antichrist made some kind of stupid agreement with them that they're going to have a temple mount. I mean, I can imagine someone using that as a political football in the Muslim world, but can you imagine the entire Muslim world going, yes, cool, that's all right, we'll worship together up here on the temple mount. I mean, I just can't see that, unless there's a huge advantage. But the huge advantage is not going to be worldwide for all Muslims. It's going to be for an individual who's trying to manipulate things. And so I could see, again, I'm just throwing this out. I see possibly an individual getting some kind of power out of Turkey and Syria, making some kind of an agreement, and the rest of the Muslim world going berserk. Egypt, the northern coast, invading. Now you got east and the north, which would be Iran and Iraq coming in. Now, that's not my final answer. I'm just saying there's that option. Or the east, you could go all the way to China, and north, you could bring Russia back into the play here. Because, again, Russia is friends with Iran, and they've been involved with Egypt and other people throughout history. So, again, it could be that far. I do want to show you this. go to Revelation 16. And this is something that people talk about. Revelation 16. And this would possibly work right here. I'm going to read this to you right here. Revelation 16. Let's begin in verse. It's the sixth bowl. The sixth angel. Chapter 16, verse 12. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. So again, you've got to really get into the book of Revelation now and decide, are you going to read this symbolic? What does this mean? Are you going to read it literal, as this refers to the Euphrates and the river dries up for the real kings coming from the east? Or are you going to be a preterist and trying to figure out how this happened in 70 AD? You know, which, good luck with that. And they do it, and they got followers. And I'm studying it right now, so heck, in a couple of weeks I may come in here and be preterist. So I'm not planning on it. The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water dried up to prepare the way for the kings of the east. Now be careful right here. Kings of the east, have you ever heard of kings from the east or magi from the east? Where did they come from? They came from Persia. You know, the wise men that came, they didn't come from China. They came from Persia. And so the kings of the east here has already been used, or a reference has already been used in the Bible, and that was from Persia. So now we're back to Iran. But let's pretend it's China. Then I saw three evil spirits that look like frogs. And of course, now are we going to go literal here? Well, you can, because now you're evil spirits. Who knows what evil spirits look like? They look like frogs. They came out of the mouth of the dragon, which would be Satan, out of the mouth of the beast, which I think is the Antichrist, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. And that's a man who is doing signs to convince people to follow the Antichrist. That would be like Antiochus Epiphanes and Menelaus. Antiochus Epiphanes, the Greek king who was persecuting the Jews, and Menelaus, the apostate Jew who sided with him to give him access to the temple. I mean, that would be what it would be like. Not necessarily that there's a connection there, but you mentioned this Satan, the man Antichrist, and the false prophet who's supporting him. That's where these demons came from. They are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs. Now again, I'm got to go literal here, because Paul talks about miraculous signs and the great deception. Several times it talked about miraculous signs being done here, and the reason God is allowing it is so that those people who have rejected the truth, they have no truth, so now they have lies. He allows a false sign, and they follow it. I mean, it's to lead them to their destruction. Now, again, if they'd embraced the truth, they would have had a discernment to walk away from it. But that's out of Thessalonians. They are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs, and they go out to the kings of the whole world. Now you see, if they were talking about the same situation. In Daniel, we seem like we're just talking about a Middle Eastern conflict. Now over here, the demons go out. We want the whole world involved. Remember, Zechariah 14 says, all of the nations have gathered around Jerusalem. In Zechariah 14, chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. And realize, when all the nations are gathered around Jerusalem to fight against it, one way of thinking about that, I'm in another book now, Zechariah, is that they all have come to destroy the Jewish people. Every nation in the world has come to destroy the Jewish people. Okay, that could be. But if this is the Antichrist and he's got the Muslim nations all in a stir, now realize, just imagine today, if Turkey and Syria were at war with Egypt and the North Africa, Iran, and they tried to get Jordan, but they couldn't. Iran gets involved in Iraq, and they're all fighting. Whoa, there's going to be some people concerned. Can you see our government? Can you see the Republicans and the Democrats all of a sudden uniting? Why, it's like, ho, that's our oil. It's like, it doesn't matter, Republican or Democrat, we've got to get this solved. So you can see, now if America, you can just play this out with me, if America gets involved in this, are they coming to destroy the Jews? Or are they coming to resolve this conflict? You see, so when it says all the nations are gathered here, it doesn't necessarily, again, it could mean that they're all anti-Semitic, they've all come to destroy the Jews. We hate the Jews, everybody's going to destroy the Jews. But it may mean that they have come in defense to resolve this or try to stop the Antichrist, because the Antichrist has broken any kind of unity or continuity that the Muslim nations have, if that's the case. And China or the East or Russia would also feel the same way. They may not be coming to fight Israel, but they may be coming to get involved in it. So, nonetheless, verse 14, they are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs, and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them for the battle on the great day of God Almighty. And then he says, behold, I come like a thief. Verse 16, then they gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. And now I think we can connect, at least I connect, Zechariah 14, when all the nations have gathered in Jerusalem to fight against it. And Armageddon, I think now we've got those verses. Now we've caught up to now the second coming right here. So these events with, again, that's why this the invasion of the king of the south against the Antichrist in Syria or Turkey is not Armageddon, because he conquers this land, takes Israel, and conquers many lands. That's not Armageddon. That's the events leading up to Armageddon. And with this thing all is now in a turmoil, now all the other nations get involved, and it's all about, I mean, today, if it happened today, it'd be about this one thing. It would be about oil. And one of the things that's repeated throughout the book of Revelation and in prophecy is it talks about the maddening wine, the thing that drives the nations mad and all the kings, the wine that drives them mad. And it's like, okay, what is that? Clearly it's not wine. I mean, they're not literally drunk on alcoholic beverages. That's not what, I mean, again, I'm all about reading it literally, but there's certain places where it obviously becomes figurative. And the wine that just drives the nations crazy. Imagine our nation. I mean, we lose oil, we do crazy things. The Democrats and the Republicans and the Tea Party would all unite. I mean, that'd be bizarre. They're drunk. They're crazy. They're uniting. I mean, that's how bizarre it would get because of this oil. And so just keep that in mind. All this is happening in the Middle East, and the thing that they've got is the oil, and there's something that drives the nations mad that they're not logical any longer because they can't lose that. Everything would stop. Again, keep that in mind. Then they gathered the kings together. The seventh angel poured out his bowl. Go over to chapter 9 of Revelation. And now I'm going to say something that you may disagree with, but that's fine, because many of you have been told, I've been told, about this king from the east, the king from the east. And I'm going to ask you, and you're going to tell me, how many soldiers does China bring into this battle? Well, here it says it right here, chapter 9, verse 16. The number of the mounted troops was 200 million. I heard their number. Now, let's go back and read this. I am going to tell you what I think here. I think people keep saying, well, that 200 million, that's a Chinese army coming to Battle of Armageddon. Indeed, it could be. And I've taught that before. I go with it, then you try to tell how many people are being born in China and how many people there are, and they could have this military. It's possible. The fact that you couldn't feed them as they marched isn't brought into the issue. Because, I mean, logistically, it's really, logistically, 200 million people marching from China to Israel. I mean, okay. I mean, you've watched Lord of the Rings. It's like, again, I don't want to sit up here and say it's impossible because, you know, I'm not an expert on these things, but just a little bit of thing, it's like, holy smokes. I do not think China, the king of the East could be China. It could be. But I guess I'm pretty sure in my own study, the 200 million is not a Chinese army. Because, read this, I think this 200 million is a spiritual force. And now all of a sudden 200 million is like, now it's completely possible, because now you've left the realm of an army marching across the Middle East trying to be fed and have water. Okay, let's just read this, just so you get this perspective. Chapter 9, verse 13. The sixth angel sounded his trumpet. Now we're with the trumpets that come before the seals. And I heard a voice coming from the horns of the golden altar that is before God. So now we are definitely in heaven. We're in the golden altar that is before God. That's the altar of incense. It said to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. Now the connecting point is, we just heard that an angel in the sixth bowl dried up the Euphrates to make way for the kings of the east. And I'm reading that literally. Now, you know, if someone's really being critical, they go, well, you're all over the place. Sometimes you're literal, sometimes you're figurative. What are you going to do? Well, that's what I'm going to do. The sixth angel dries up the Euphrates River, and the kings of the east march across. That could be China. That could be Iran. That I think are kings that are coming into the day of battle for Armageddon. But this right here, just because it mentions Euphrates, maybe you should disagree with me. They're bound up. These angels are, four angels are bound up at the great river Euphrates. Release the angels, and the four angels who had been kept ready for this very hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. Four angels are released to kill a third of mankind? Well, that's possible. You only need one, I suppose. The number of the mounted troops was 200 million. Now, that's China? That's China's military? You see, it could be. I'm not saying it's not. But in context, that is not connected to the kings coming from the east when the angel dries up the Euphrates River. This is talking about four angels who have been bound at the river Euphrates who are given a command, go out and kill a third of mankind. And then it tells you the number of mounted troops that I think go with them are 200 million. I heard their number. I think that is 200 million angelic or spiritual forces that they're not Chinese, I don't think. Again, you don't have to go with that. The horses, and now here it describes the Chinese military. The horses and riders I saw in my vision looked like this. Their breastplates were fiery red, dark blue, and yellow as sulfur. They just hope that's in the Chinese flag, you know. The heads of the horses resemble the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and sulfur. Well, that's a modern, you know, and I don't know if I agree with this whole thing. Well, that is John in the first century describing a modern tank. Okay, and maybe so. But again, when did we start talking about tanks? We're talking, I think, about angelic, or we're just still describing demonic or angelic forces, I believe, just like we saw the frogs. Look, the demons look like frogs. Now we're describing the demonic force here. A third of mankind was killed by the three plagues of fire, smoke, and sulfur that came from their mouths. The power of the horses was in their mouths and in their tails. And their tails were like snakes having heads with which they inflicted injury. The rest of mankind were not killed by these plagues. They still did not repent at the work of their hands. They did not stop worshiping demons and idols and gold, silver, bronze, stone, wood, idols that cannot see or hear or walk, nor did they repent of their murderers, their magic arts, their sexual immorality, or their thefts. In other words, now mankind is still living in rebellion. And the idea there is when God unleashes judgment, it's well-deserved because these people had a chance. God is warning them with these destructions. You can't change, and they don't want to change. And so just that kind of sets the stage up for God's ultimate judgment there. Okay. That's enough on that. Let's go back to Daniel. And like I said right here in chapter 11, verse 44, it mentions, but reports from the east and the north will alarm him, the Antichrist, and he'll set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. And so with all these things that we've talked about so far tonight, the Antichrist coming out of Syria, potentially Turkey, he's invaded from by Egypt. He comes back against Egypt and takes all of the northern Africa. He also takes Israel, which I think now takes place at the halfway point. He can't get Jordan or part of Saudi Arabia. But there is a king of the north, maybe coming out of Russia or further north of Turkey. And from the east, could be all the way to China, or it could simply be Iraq and Iran come in and get involved in this. When this takes place, that's when those frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, the false prophet, and the Antichrist, bringing all the nations into war. And this is where you start seeing maybe the king from the east coming in and another invasion from the north coming in that's mentioned. And we're setting the stage now for Armageddon. So again, these things are probably all happening in this 3.5-4 year period right here. I would assume, for example, the initial invasion of Egypt up into Syria against the Antichrist would have happened with about 4 years to go. So again, I'm speculating. So you've got about 6 months of this whole thing happening. The Antichrist marches off, takes Israel, ends his treaty with them, and that sets the stage of all these battles, and he's sweeping through nations, and other nations are gathering together, and it's all being prepared. So you've got about a four-year period in preparation for the Battle of Armageddon. In other words, it doesn't happen in an afternoon. Everybody's living happily, right around the streets in town. Hey, all of a sudden, we all want to go to Israel and fight a war. It's been building for 4 years, and it actually began when the Antichrist signed some kind of a treaty giving Israel access to the Temple Mount, which again may not be this great idea that the whole Muslim world says, oh, great idea, let's let Israel worship with us. It may set the stage, and he's got enough power and military force, because it says he worships God of military, to maintain this position for a period of time, looking like peace, peace. And Jesus warns, Paul talks, when men say peace, peace, and destruction is near, because the Muslims are not going to let this happen. And again, where does Ezekiel 38:39 happen? I think it happens up here, which may be the reason, because at that time, all the Muslim nations are attacked by God. They all crumble. Remember the story, Ezekiel 38:39, from Persia up here in northern Turkey, all along the coast over here in Africa. They're destroyed, and it mentions they'll have 7 years where Israel will use the weapons that were left behind for fuel, which is interesting because Iran right now is saying they're making fuel out of, atomic fuel or something. And are they or are they not? But Israel's going to get it somehow, and they're going to be using it for fuel during the seven-year period. And this is going to set the stage when all these kingdoms are neutralized or maybe even destroyed. That is going to set the stage for the Antichrist, I think, to say, okay, coming out of Syria, we'll give Israel part of the access to the Temple Mount, and they resume their worship. And during these 3 years, Muslims are disappointed, they're upset, they're rebuilding until now finally get enough energy to come up here and attack Syria, and now we're into our story tonight. Does that make sense to you at all? That is completely speculation, just tying things together. And if someone would come up and make a representation of this, they could destroy everything I said and counteract it in another way, and they may be right, okay? The only thing you're going to have real trouble with is saying all this happened already in 70 AD in Jerusalem. Let's go back to the text here and wrap this up. Verse 44, chapter 11, verse 44. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, the Antichrist, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. Now, this many may be a reference, as it is other places, to Israel, to Jewish people. To annihilate many, and it refers to Jewish people. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, which kind of reads back into who is the many. If he's trying to destroy Germans, then why is he setting up his tent and his military forces in Israel, in Jerusalem? So that many, annihilate many, he now is now actively killing and persecuting Jews. And Jesus says to the Jews at that time, flee to the mountains. And again, that was the case. That was the case in 60. Now, this is where the preterist idea works. Because in 66 AD, the Christians who would learn and follow Jesus' teachings, when he says, when you see Israel or the armies surrounding Jerusalem, flee to the mountains. And they did. We know that from Christian early church writings, that the bishop of Jerusalem or the pastor of Jerusalem led the church. This is the one who replaced James, Jesus' brother, as the pastor. He led them across the Jordan River up here into Decapolis, into this area. And then they came back in like 71, 72 AD and reestablished the church. They just left for 6 years and came back after the destruction was finalized. And so they followed that. And the same thing will be true. The Jews can be fleeing over here just across the river into Jordan for protection. Now, how? I don't know. Is it just because they're mountains? I mean, I guess, Osama bin Laden, he's been hiding in mountains and caves now for, two decades or something. I suppose the Jews can go over here and hide in mountains and caves and no one could find them. But you sure think that if you've got a massive amount, finding Osama is one thing. Finding Jews and their families hiding in the mountains in Moab or Edom, it seems like it'd be a little bit easier, But nonetheless, let's look at this again. Verse 45, he goes out to destroy many. In 45, he will pitch his royal tents between the seas, Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, at the beautiful holy mountain. That's the Temple Mount. I mean, he may actually be on the Temple Mount at that. He may actually mean he camps on the holy mountain, on the Temple Mount. Yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. So again, when the time is, he'll come to his end, and when it says no one will help him, that may mean he is the, again, if we're still playing this out with a Muslim-Islam scenario, he is the lone Muslim standing there, and the other Islamic nations are like, you're on your own, and they just watch him just get crushed. But of course, you've got Jesus Christ coming back also here at the same time. In fact, chapter 12 begins with that. At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. Now, what does at that time mean? Does that mean after he's pitched his tent on the holy mountain, at that time, in the final moments of the tribulation, Michael arises? Or does that mean at the time of the end, when all these things started taking place, that time of wrath that is being poured out at that time? I like to, like I've said before, I like to put it at that time, at the time of the wrath, Michael will arise, the prince of Israel, the guardian angel will arise. And we've tied that together in, let's go ahead and read it if you don't mind. I've said it several times. Go to 1 Thessalonians. Again, I'm teaching this, and I don't want to say I believe this. That's kind of a commitment. I wonder about this. I think this possibly fits. 1 Thessalonians, and we're going to look at those verses about the rapture or the catching away of the church, the harpazo. People make fun of the rapture. They say it's not even in the Bible, but talks about the harpazo, the catching away, being caught up. That means to be taken by force. It's exactly the word that was used when Philip was taken by the Spirit and came down in another place, astos. He was taken. He was harpazoed. He was raptured. It's the same word. So people can make fun and say, well, it's not even in the Bible, but yes, it is. We've even got an action photo of an action story of Philip being in one place. Boom, the Spirit harpazoed him, and now he's in another city 15 miles away. Harpazoed. And so when we bump into this, there it is. It's like, let it mean what it means. And people will say, well, that's what it means. Well, go, okay, maybe not. Verse 14 of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We believe that Jesus died and rose again, so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him. So when Jesus is coming back, those who have died in him are coming back. We're not going to just go to heaven and stay. We're coming back with him. What, just for a tour? I mean, he's just going to show us how to fly back to earth? He's going to show how I got here? Why are we coming back with him? But nonetheless, according to the Lord's own word, now again, we don't know what this Lord's own word is. It's not recorded in Matthew or John or something. It's something that the disciples continued to teach. The Lord said this, but no one ever wrote it down. And they told Paul about it because Paul didn't hear the Lord teach. He would have received this information as authoritative information from the other apostles that had walked with Jesus. Or you can say Paul received this revelation or this word from God that God set Paul down and told it to him. It seems to tend more that this is something that Jesus taught his disciples that they didn't really write down, which John says that at the end of his book. He says, if everything Jesus did and said was written down, I suppose the world couldn't hold the books. In other words, he gives you that wide open range. Of course, there's a lot of goofy stuff that people say about Jesus, but John gives you that window there of there is a lot of things. Well, why didn't the apostles write it down? Well, John tells you why they didn't write it down. We can't write down everything. He did so. The whole world would be filled with books. This is what John ends his book. I gave you seven signs so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. Verse 15, according to the Lord's own word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left till the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. Now, just so you know, this is one of the attacks that people will use against my theology or my eschatology. Because Paul, unless he was in error, which of course that would really undermine the scripture, Paul says, we who are still alive. Paul was talking about events that were going to happen while he was still alive. And so, again, I have no trouble with that. I think Paul was talking about us, the church, who are still alive. But as time progressed, he's not part of that any longer. He's died and gone on. But we, still the church, who are still alive, who remain. I have no trouble with that, but some people make that a big deal because it's like clearly Paul was talking about something that was going to happen before he died. If you're a preterist, you teach it this way. We who are still alive, meaning it happened before Paul died. But if you're a skeptic, you say, see, Paul was confused. He didn't know the Bible's not true. If you're me, you just say it means the church, and we, the church, were still alive, and Paul just happened to die, like many people have, but still we, the church, if we're here, we'll still, nonetheless, you know what I'm saying. According to the Lord's own word, we tell you the truth. We tell you that we who are still alive, who are left till the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep or died. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven. That's Jesus. That's Zechariah 14 again. That's Acts chapter 1, the Lord descending on the Mount of Olives. That's the second coming. That's Revelation chapter 19. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command. Oh, excuse me. I made a mistake. Did you catch that mistake? Yeah, thank you. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command. This I referred to Zechariah 14, Revelation 19. I slipped into the second coming, Acts chapter 1. This would not be the second coming. That was me just making a mistake. This is 7 years before the second coming, unless you tie it together and unless you are, which you could be, that's fine, a post-trib, which means the rapture takes place at the end of the 7 years. And so the Lord's coming back, then I would have been exactly right. I sounded post-trib there, didn't I? Okay? And if you're post-trib, that's fine. That's a healthy doctrine. I don't agree with it. I think something different. But it's in the same area as this. It's like arguing about when Ezekiel 38 and 39 is going to take place. It's like, I think it happens here, but if you think it happens here, you might be right. You know, I think the rapture happens here, but if you think it happens at the second coming, I don't think so. But you may be right. You're not a heretic, you know. Okay, so anyway, the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel. There it is. That's what I'm looking for. When the Lord comes down, there's the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God. And the loud command, I think, is seen possibly in Revelation chapter 4 when John's vision begins and Jesus says, "Come up here, and I will show you what must soon take place." When he says, "Come up here," that may be the beginning of, that may be, and then the tribulation unfolds, that may be the command, "Come up here and meet him in the air." But notice there at the command, "with the voice of the archangel." That is none other than Michael. And so when Jesus comes down with the command, there's the voice of the archangel, Michael. All of a sudden, Michael is mentioned. What is he? Why is he mentioned? Maybe it's just, well, that's just, we want to talk about angels right here. Or maybe it is an actual eschatological event that when the church goes up, Michael returns because there's 7 years of Israel left, and Michael is Israel's prince. Do you understand what I'm saying? So we go back to chapter 12 of Daniel. And now we can spin this two ways, and you've got your ammunition from that last verse. At that time, again, in context of chapter 12, I'm wrapping this up here. I got to quit. What time is it going to be? Yeah, we got to quit. At that time, Michael. Okay, after we talk about all this tonight, at that time, is that right here at the very end? Is that when Michael returns? Or at that time, is it these events when Michael returns? Now watch. The verse I just read, I'm saying Jesus is coming down to rapture us, and Michael is coming down. Jesus is taking us back to heaven for the judgment seat of Christ and the marriage supper of the Lamb, and then we'll return with him with our linens fine and clean. It says that in Revelation 19. Linens fine and clean represent the good deeds of the saints, and those who come back with the Lord are dressed in fine linen. It's the same chapter describes where the fine linen comes from. They come from good deeds done by the saints. So it comes as a result of the judgment seat of Christ that's taking place up here, and we're coming back with our rewards. Okay? So Michael, the rapture, now he's in the last 7 years. But if you're going to go back to post-trib and the rapture takes place right here, that we're taken up to meet the Lord on his return to the Mount of Olives, well then at that time, Michael, the great prince, will arise. And so Michael, now you've got the second coming, the rapture, and the return of Michael all at the same time. I don't agree with that, but I'm just saying you could make that happen right there. And the verse would still line up. Chapter 12, verse 1, "At that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise," which means he's set down. Now he's coming back. "There'll be a time of distress such as not happened from the beginning of nations until then." Okay, now that's going to, where are you at? Are you before or after? Now I'm before. Now you've got Michael appearing. Now you've got this verse is now pre-trib rapture, you see, because of that. "There will be a time of distress such as not happened from the beginning of nations until then," and that would be the seven-year tribulation. And understand, when you go with the preterist, they say that time period was the destruction of Jerusalem. And they say this phrase is a hyperbole. It's just an expression. It doesn't actually mean it's the worst time ever. It means, oh, it's really bad, but it's not literally the worst time ever. The problem is, how are you going to get all of these events into 70 AD? Or are you still talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, persecution during the Maccabean Revolt? You see what I'm saying? I mean, there's different ways of putting this together, and some people are really, I think, jumping some hurdles, some major hurdles to get this explained. And for me, it seems real simple. There will be a time of distress that should not happen from the beginning of time until then, the tribulation. And it's repeated throughout the Bible. But at that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. Again, that's talking about the Jews. This is where I want to get into Romans, and maybe we'll pick this up next week. Multitudes of sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Well, now you're into the resurrection. This is clearly not the Maccabean Revolt. It's clearly not the 70 AD, although they do explain it for that people, because now the Jews were set aside, and right here, everyone whose name is found written in the book, the Jews are destroyed, but all the Jews whose names are found in the book of life, they move into the church age in 70 AD, and it says, multitudes will sleep in the dust of the earth, the Jewish nation is gone, but some will arise now to the church age. They are now part of the bride of Christ, and the other Jews now perish and go to destruction. And so you have a resurrection in the preterist theory, preterist idea, with the church, the beginning of the church is the resurrection. So in other words, this has all been fulfilled. Okay, I'm just saying that's a stretch. But if they teach that, if they teach it hard enough and long enough to a group of people, they laugh at you because you're talking about the resurrection taking place over here and you've got rapture and they're making money for this because they've got it all figured out. Which, okay, good luck. Multitudes of sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to the shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there and increase in knowledge. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others. One of them, now we're going to go back to the angels, and we're going to see that man is going to appear again, I think it's Jesus Christ or the Son of God, is going to appear. He's still there talking to his angels, giving them directions to teach, talk to Daniel. Yes, Mira.
That first phrase of verse 1 of 12, at that time, is that referring,
at the time of the end?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think,
that's
yeah.
Back.
Maybe. I don't know much about mid-trib. I've never really studied it.
Because it could be read during that time, Michael was standing
up. Okay. Right.
And I'm wondering, I've often wondered where they get the mid-trib.
Yeah, I think, I don't know for sure. Is anybody here mid-trib? Now they're going to raise your hand. What's that?
I've read a book.
What'd they say? Doesn't most of it come out of Revelation?
Yeah.
The different people popping up into heaven, a different vision than different people showing up or something?
Well,
what?
Then the rapture happens, and then the wrath comes.
Oh, okay.
The great, right.
So based out of maybe those verses in early Revelation, what is it, the church of Thyatira or something? No. Whatever. But where I will spare you from the tribulation, is that the verse? And then
the book I read called it the pre-wrath.
Right, and then Paul's writing in Thessalonians, talks about, yeah. Okay, is that it? Is that the verse? I mean, that's the hinge. Because we still have a pre-wrath rapture. You know, if this is the 7 years, if this is called the 7 years or the period of wrath, time of wrath. Okay. Okay. Right, okay.
Did I hear you say that it could be possible that the king of the north would come against the king of the south?
Right.
Did you say that?
Yeah.
It says the king of the north shall come against him. Now, is that...
Right, that him. I'm thinking that him there is the king of the south. When the king of the south goes out to attack him, but then he will attack him back.
Okay, because I...
Does that make sense?
It would be inconsistent
okay.
with the application of the pronoun in that passage, because the pronoun he, his, or him.
Right.
That would be the...
Now, what are you reading? What's translation? What translation are you using?
New King James.
Okay, does anybody have anything different that... Like, what's it say in the Japanese Bible?
It's very hard to tell which is the key.
Okay. What do you think, Tim?
I thought north was the Antichrist.
And that when he goes against him, he's going against the king of the south? Right.
So, seems to talk about that same area.
Right. Yeah. That's why I do that same thing there, because it's like we've just spent an entire chapter developing the king of the north and the king of the south being Egypt and Syria, and now to just take a couple steps, it's like all of a sudden you can switch characters, but to change maps, I think would be, you know, you should probably say the king of the far north or the king of the northeast or something, instead of using that same term. It seems like that's got to be consistent. I don't know. That's why I kind of began that whole discussion at the beginning of the night of, do you have the king, Antichrist, the king of the south, and the king of the north, and they both invade the king, Antichrist? That would make him probably a Roman, or, you know, someone from the... It doesn't have to be, but I mean, if these guys are coming down against them, they're attacking. Yep.
The only time we didn't use it as the Antichrist in that passage.
Right.
Just looking at this verse, it could be either way, but like you brought up all the other parts, how the word is used.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as this develops, where did the king of the north go? I mean, he invaded the king, and then all of a sudden, now you got the Antichrist, he's sweeping through all these kingdoms, and where did the king of the north go? I mean, it's like so I mean, that's why I think he's got to be... Again, that's not an adamant final statement. I'm just saying it just makes sense.
Like you say, when it happens, we'll know. I mean,
right,
maybe,
right.
Maybe you didn't know, but,
right.
I mean, that is really, I think, I'm remembering a friend of ours who said that prophecy like this is not to understand the future so much as to understand the present. In other words, when we move into it.
Right, yeah. And again, people who have embraced this and they're trying to wrap their mind around it. And again, not that you're going to be an eschatological freak, but it's like we've covered these verses. Now we move on to another book. We've covered these verses, and now you've embraced the truth per se. And when it happens, and when the deception comes, it's like you haven't turned your back on the truth. You maybe didn't understand all the details, but you have the word of truth here, and all of a sudden it's like, I see what's happening. So I mean. I'm going to try to explain. I'm going to try to understand it, but at the same time, you've got to believe that this is still, you know, a mystery to some extent.
Right. I have a question. It's not about the king, but it is about verse 44, where it says the reports. Are those reports that are people that are coming to Christ and that he's, you know, against them, and those are the people that he's destroying besides the Jews, or what are the reports?
I think, I'm thinking here, I'm going to read this again, but I think the reports are, and again, there'll be Jews and Christians, there'll be people coming to Christ, and again, there really won't be, there may be some anti-Semitic activity, clearly, but people that are coming are Jews and Gentiles are still, they're coming into, you know, faith in Christ at that time. It's really not the church, and this is where, like, some Reformed teaching gets upset, because the church has been removed, and yet we still have people coming into this church, but it's no longer the church. So say, how can people be getting saved if there's no church any longer? And it's like, well, I mean, I mean, the church is a unit from this period of time, the church age, but Christ saved people before, and they're not in the church, but of course, John Calvin and the Reformers, they're all in the church. It's all just real one real big family. So, I mean, I have no trouble with that. So, yeah, there'd be Jews and Gentiles coming to Christ. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Yeah, the way we understand it. I mean, that's what you and it makes sense to us. But then they start changing things, and it's like then all of a sudden it's like, well, you know, then they make it sound like you're making stuff up.
It's being baptized into Christ, not baptized into the church. That's where we get that kind of
right. Okay, verse 44, but reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he'll sit down in great rage. Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. See, I'm reading that like you've got military scouts out there that are and say, oh, we're being invaded from the east and being invaded from the north will alarm him, and he'll sit out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. I see. So why? Because the militaries are attacking him, why would he go out and destroy believers? Why? What do you think? I mean, is that just something you saw there?
Yeah,
or has anybody ever, do you understand what she's saying there?
I mean, if the Antichrist is getting reports that all of these people are coming to have faith in Jesus Christ, and so he is out to destroy not the military per se,
right,
but the people who are coming
right
to have faith in Christ.
That's because there's no context there. I mean, unless you read it from another verse because of I'm reading military in there because it's all about military. I did write this in my footnote here. I didn't pay attention to it. But I did write, but reports from the east and the north will alarm him. And the report I wrote down in here, Revelation 16:12, the Euphrates has dried up. Now, that's just a speculation. That's not, you know, what report comes from the east? The Euphrates River, our border, our defense is gone. And now it's like, well, I better get down here. And just like he goes down in a rage and destroys and annihilates many, we do have a pattern of that with Antiochus Epiphanes. When they drew the circle around him, the Romans drew a circle around him and says, what are you going to do? He had a surrender and went up and began destroying the Jews and trying to get a foothold there so he had a place for defense. And so this, if it's similar, when he hears that, he knows his back is against the wall and he responds the same way Antiochus does, goes to Jerusalem and tries to make that a stronghold. But yeah. Again, I'm reading military into that, but what you say, what are the reports? The reports about mass revivals, and now he's trying, now he begins to persecute.
He is anti-Christ.
Yeah.
That's,
what about
that's
it
what
being,
is.
So what she's talking about, because this, in the scenario you have, when he's headed down to Egypt, that's basically when he breaks the covenant, sacks Israel.
Right. Right. True. Right, because that, right here, this is when, and that's why I wanted to get into Zechariah 13. I said that earlier, because this, Zechariah 13, is where the Jews are like, oh my gosh. And that's when the fountain is open, and now the Jews are coming to Christ, and they realize this guy is, and then he starts, yeah.
Maybe that's what happened. He thinks he's won. He's overrun all that, and all of a sudden revival breaks out in Israel.
Yeah, because when he breaks the treaty, they realize we've been deceived. Jordan.
The Jordan will be converted as well, or many of them.
Right.
And so from the east and the north.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, because, yeah, the reports. And what are the reports? The reports could be the deterioration of his religious hold on the area. The Muslims are becoming to Christ or something. Yeah.
And you questioned earlier why Jordan, why were they protected in Jordan? Perhaps that statement in the first part of the scripture says at that time the archangel Michael comes, maybe he comes to protect them.
Right. Yeah.
Because there's no protection there, they can see.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe there's some kind of a military, and maybe they have converted, because I mean there is when we, you know, when I talk about Jews and Gentiles in my mind, I'm thinking about Jews and European. But it's like that wouldn't be the case. This would be Jews and the Gentiles. The Gentiles in this case are Muslims. They're Middle Eastern people. It's not Iowans. So I mean, so, you know, just your mind gets in these rabbit holes, and it's like you're not really thinking. And so Jordan may be, it involves Michael. It may involve they become Christian or they're not, you know, believers, and they've got some kind of protection. You know, yeah, that's very good. Right.
I mean,
because he appears to be able to, yeah, because he says he's got all this.
But power over Christians,
yeah. What he's worried about is people coming.
Yeah. Not so much.
Yeah.
Mind, not
yeah.
Much
yeah. And now it'd be not now it'd be good to go back with that idea. Now this is what happens here. You get an idea. Now you go back and you read Revelation again, and now you start seeing clue, you know, what you just said. Now it makes sense what you're saying. Now what the test is going to be, now go back and read through all those eschatological verses again and see, it's like now more comes together. I mean, you know what I'm saying? If it's true, it's going to light up. If it's just, well, no, that's not right, it's going to start to fall apart. Yeah, but no, Yeah, and good point there, a good teaching moment too is I read right through that. But reports from the East, clearly military reports, and now he's out destroying people. And it's like, whoa, you know. Yeah, there's a good thing. It's like, yeah, very good. All right, I'll pray.